So this is the midpoint of Lent here at Imago. So our Lent this year is only 5 weeks instead of six. It's Lent light. it's really not. And so this is the midpoint. So I wanted to take a minute before I start talking and before we jump into this morning's and just, can we pause for a second and reflect? How's Lent going? That's the question. How is Lent going? And specifically maybe the practices over the first 2 weeks about love God and loving yourself, or maybe you've had other Lenten practices, or maybe you have nothing at all and you're like ambivalent about Lent, and that's okay too. But I just wanted to give space to maybe reflect on what has Lent been like so far this year for you. What are you learning? What are you frustrated by? What's going well? Yeah, good. Did you all hear that? There's some good phrases there. How fragile my sense of God's love is. I think that if I ask for hands, right? Like, that's a lot of us. Yeah, good. Right. That everybody's as messed up as I am or as undisciplined as I am. Yeah. Yeah, doing hard things together is so much easier, right? Like, if you've ever, like, trained for a marathon or something and done a running group, I've heard it's a lot easier than just going out by yourself every day. That's not the way I've done it personally, but I've just heard lots of people, like, little plug, if you want to do Steamboat this year, I'm sure those groups are firing up, that there's a lot of people that run Steamboat every year, and they start somewhere around here and start getting ready, and they call it Building Steam, I think. Yeah. All right. So this morning, we're going to move. We talked first about loving God. Then we talked last week, Michael Danner was here and talked about loving the self as God loves us. And this morning, we're going to talk about loving others. I just love that. That's really beautiful. So I was sharing with somebody this morning, and I told my wife the other day, like, this feels like the hardest talk in the world to do because it feels like a talk that we've done 1,000 times here, right? Like, no duh. Like, everybody, here's the profound thought this morning. We're supposed to love other people. All right, let's go home, right? Like, that's a little bit when I saw this one of all the topics we're doing, like, oh, this is the one that is the hardest. So we're going to try to come at it maybe from a different angle, think about it in a little different way. And to do that, I want to have two passages of scripture this morning. So I'm going to assign one side of the room a passage, then I'm going to assign the other side of the room a passage, and then I'm just going to let you read for a minute or two. We're going to be quiet and let you read, and then I'm going to have this side teach that side their passage, and then this side teach that side. Does that make sense? All right? And so we're going to look at the common themes in them. So if you're on my right, on stage left, stage right is my right, I want you to go to the Mark passage, Mark 5, 25 to 34. And if you're on my left, your right, go to Luke 19, 1 to 10. So what I want you to do is read the passage. I'm going to ask somebody to give us a synopsis and then tell us the key things that you notice or see in those passages. I'm going to wait for you to turn there, and then I'll flip the slide while you're doing that. So I'm going to give you about a minute. It shouldn't take you more than about a minute to read those. All right. Hemorrhaging woman group. Give us... you are the official hemorrhaging women. That's your team motto. So, what's that?
At least I read the right passage.
Right. It's a really bizarre passage. So, will somebody over here help us over here understand what happens in this passage? Dan, nice and loud so we can hear it way over here.
A woman who had been bleeding for 12 years couldn't get help, but she went to Jesus and touched his cloak in the crowd, and she was healed, and Jesus felt power go from him, so he turned around and said, "Who touched me?" And she was fearful. Permission, but
yeah.
You seem to be okay with it. I say, your faith is what
you'll
do. Go
and peace. Yeah, good. What are the key insights from the rest of you all? What did you get out of that passage? First of all, can I say my favorite? I love the disciples' reaction to Jesus. When Jesus says, "Somebody touch me," what do they say? Duh, you're in a crowd, dummy. Of course somebody touched you, right? All right, so that's my interpretation of what they said to Jesus. I like to think that they called Jesus dummy a lot. Anyway. Why was she fearful? I'm asking you guys to teach us. Are you asking me? Tell me, why do you think she's fearful? Why do you think she's fearful? Yeah. She's fearful because she's unclean. So a little bit of Jewish law here to this story. Because of her condition, she would have been ceremonially unclean. She would have been ostracized from the society. So for 12 years, no contact with anyone, probably lives on the outskirts. So to go touch someone, and specifically to touch a man, and even more specifically to touch a man who's a leader, rabbi, respected religious man, respected religious man, all of those things are really improper for her to do. So her fear is probably related to this isn't okay for her to do. She is stepping way outside cultural expectations and norms. Yeah. She shouldn't even be in the crowd. Yeah, exactly. Amidst her fear, she reaches out and she touches him. Good. Anything else? Ooh, that preaches well. Did you all hear that? Which makes her faith greater than her fear. It kind of comes to that moment. Her faith is greater than her fear. All right, good. You all, tell us your passage. Somebody tell us what your passage is over here, nice and loud.
It's a wee little story of a wee little man.
Who climbed up in a... You all just want to sing? And as the Savior passed that way, he looked up in the tree and he said... They have a song. So what do we notice? This one is a bit obscure story. Sorry. This one is super well known. What do we see in the story? What's significant and interesting? Yeah, so good to play these two stories against each other. The one, she approaches Jesus, touches Jesus, and he responds. This one, Zacchaeus is in a tree over here, kind of off the... I read it as like Zacchaeus and then like crowds, and Jesus picks him out of the tree. Dude up in the tree. I'm coming over. Which would freak most of us out, right? What if I just started doing that on Sunday morning? Like, you know, just pointed somebody in the crowd like, hey, you're having me over for lunch. I'm not Jesus. I'm not trying to play Jesus in this story. I just think it's funny that Jesus is like, I'm showing up. Lunch. Your place. Awesome. Anything else you notice? Yeah. Yeah. They're kind of annoyed that he does it. Why did I pick these two stories? What do they have in common? And why would I pick two stories? These don't usually go together. We don't usually preach these two stories together. Why did I pick these two? What's the commonality? Personal. What else, Renee? Yeah, undesirables. A crook. Yeah, there's that piece. Where I go with both of these, what seems significant to me in both these stories, is that before we can actually love others, first we have to see others. That in both stories, she comes to Jesus, and in the bump and jostle of the crowd, he could have easily kept moving. We can easily see people and whatever's going on, and we can just keep moving. And he picks out Zacchaeus in both stories. He saw that he took the time to see what others were experiencing so that he could love them well. The whole time we've been doing this, there's been a picture on the screen behind me. I saw this picture 20 years ago, and I've never forgotten this picture. Anybody notice anything about it? What'd you just say? You think there's a lion in the background? So this picture was taken in 1988 in Orange County, California. Now, remember that when you take pictures in 1988, they're not on your phone. You send them into a place. I'm going to educate my boys here just a minute. So back in the old days, when we took pictures, we had to send them off. And then like a week later, we would go back and we would pick up the pictures, and they were printed on little pieces of paper like this big, and we would look at our pictures. So he took this picture, got it back a week later or whatever, and noticed that standing behind his wife and daughter, right there. Do you see it yet? If I zoom in, there's a mountain lion. They developed... Have you seen this before? Do you actually see that? That's awesome. Yeah, that's amazing. Honestly, if you see the actual picture, it's harder to see on the screen. It was a lot easier to see on my computer. Scary, right? To develop your family pictures, and I'm just going to go back so you can see it. Like, to develop your family pictures and then find in the background that there was a mountain lion there. This is the kind of stuff that my wife and I joke. So some of you know Enneagram stuff, like she's a six and she's like, what if there's a mountain lion in our picture? And I'd make fun of her for said things. And then you get it back and like, oh, except the time that there was a mountain lion in our picture. I've never forgotten this picture. Jennifer and I saw it. There was a picture of this in the Denver Zoo back when we lived in Denver. And we visited the zoo and they had a big print of this. And they were talking about a couple things. One is how well mountain lions can blend into the scenery. And then also, this art, I saw this picture again where I found it online, because I haven't been able to find this for years, and I just found it. National Geographic did an article about a year or two ago about mountain lions living in populated areas. So if you live in LA in particular, there's mountain lions all over the city. Because it's in the mountains, and they are now tracking some of these mountain lions, and so some of these wilderness areas, mountain lions are living very close to human beings, and mountain lions, preferred size of prey is about a 3-year-old. When we lived in Colorado, it was not uncommon to hear about a family hiking, and a 3 or 4-year-old would go running down the trail like they always do, and mountain lions would pounce because it's perfect size. All that to say, that picture was on the screen for about 5 minutes, and we didn't see it, right? And unless somebody points it to you, you don't see. And I think that's what really moved in me when I started thinking about this idea of man, that's so creepy. That's what moved in me this week as I started thinking about what does it mean to love others. If we're going to make part of our Lenten practice that first of all we love God, and then we start learning to love ourselves in a way that God loves us. And I'm sure Michael Danner did a great job in this, and not in an ego way, but in like, I love myself in the same way that God loves me. Then if I'm going to start to love others well, I have to see them. I'm going to have to see who they are. I'm going to have to see what they're suffering. I'm going to have to see them. And much of our life, it's easy. It's so easy not to see the suffering and not to see the pain of the people around us. That we get so busy, and I think Jesus is a great example in this story over here, that Jesus is such a great example of this, is that what we've been seeing, remember a couple weeks ago, I made out a calendar of Jesus's schedule for the day, and it's super busy, and especially when we're reading Mark, it's super busy, and he's moving from place to place, and he's teaching, and there's lots of crowds, and in the middle of all that, it would be really easy to just ignore this woman who touches his garment and is healed, and yet what we see in Jesus is that he stops in that moment and attends to the needs of this woman because he saw her. We see that he responds to Zacchaeus, right? Because he looked up in the tree and he saw Zacchaeus hiding in the tree so he wouldn't exactly be seen by Jesus. And it really starts making me think about how much of my life I don't see. We all have a certain amount of blindness to things. My wife claims that I can't find anything if it's in front of my face. She's right, to be fair. Don't tell her. She's not in here this morning, so I can say that. But like when she says, did you check the spice rack? And I'm like, where's the oregano? And check the spice rack? Yeah, I checked it. And then she walks out, and you know what she does? Like she opens the door, and she's like, there it is, dummy. She doesn't call me a dummy. That's just, I don't know what's going on this morning with that. There's so much of our life we just move through and we don't see. I literally the other day had a bunch of stuff on my desk and I was like, where did I put that thing? And then I paused for a minute and you know where that thing was? It was right in the middle of my desk because I just didn't see it. And it makes me wonder as we move through my life and as we all move through our lives and we're supposed to be loving others, how much of others' sufferings either I don't see because of not bad intention, I just don't see, but that I choose not to see. I choose not to look. We call this idea, there's an idea here called blind spots, right? What's a blind spot? I'll give you a hint. It's a spot you can't see. We have driver number 2 getting his permit this week, and we will have a discussion on Wednesday about blind spots, So it's exciting. I have another chauffeur for a year. It's gorgeous. Blind spots are these areas that we can't see. And I think that one of my, I think one of the pathways to growth, spiritually or in any other way, parenting, marriage, whatever, is a recognition and a growing awareness that we all have them. We all have things that the way our life is set up, the way we go about things, we just don't see. And seeing, like Jesus saw both of these people, the woman and Zacchaeus, takes a lot of work. And I wanted to spend a couple minutes here because I think this is such an important idea. And I want to talk about the different ways in that we don't see. We call these biases. Anybody familiar with this idea? So let's work through this together and teach each other. And maybe if you have examples of this, you can share. I have my own. What is confirmation bias? Confirmation bias means we aren't able to see because what? Do you know? Yes. Good. Yeah. Confirmation bias is where we look for the things we want to see. So how many of you have had the experience of buying a new car and you choose that I'm going to buy a, somebody pick a car. Okay. You would notice Lamborghinis on the road anyway. Let's lower our expectations, son. And let's say that maybe someday you're looking to buy a Chevy Volt. What do you start seeing on the road everywhere you go? Anything you buy, you start seeing it on the road. Every time. That's confirmation bias. We see the things that confirm what we're already looking for. And so when we start looking for a new car, we start noticing that everywhere we go. When we, whatever the thing is, if we have a new hairstyle or we're thinking about a new hairstyle, what do you see? Everybody that has that hairstyle. So how does that become a blind spot? Yes, that's actually a different bias we're going to get to in just a second. Hold that one. It's similar. It's very similar. Confirmation bias is what? Yeah. I start seeing only the things I want to see that confirm what I already thought in the first place. So when somebody's talking about their lives, I just see the things that I want to see. Yeah. Yeah, that's so good. So when this talks, when we start talking about loving others, that really made this connection really well. When we talk about loving others and our blind spot, and when it's a confirmation bias, that means sometimes what one of the ways that looks like is that if Chris is always a super bubbly, happy person, and then he's not, I just rule it out. Because it's not what I already knew. It's not what I expect. I always see you this way. There's a great example to this one, by the way. Do you know that LeBron James, early in his career, was terrible at free throws? Terrible. Anybody know this? All right, just pretend you do now. All right? So he started working on it over years, worked on it hard. And like 6 or 7 years later, there's plenty of evidence, like the stats are, he was a pretty good free throw shooter. You know what announcers still said about him? He's bad at free throws. He can't hit free throws in clutch situations because they were just looking for the thing that they always knew and couldn't see what was actually becoming. So that's one. Let's go to the second one. Availability bias. Anybody know what this is? You can make guesses. It's fine. I won't shame you. What's availability bias? Yeah, it's the information that comes to us easily is the one that we just believe it because it's right there. So if every morning I listen to the news, that's what I'm going to believe. Even if that news source isn't good, it's just right there, and so I believe it. Or that person who I sit by at work who has all the information and tells me, well, that person said, it's not that they're an expert and not that I actually should believe them, it's just the information I see. So when it talks about loving people and availability bias, the blind spot here is that we just see the most convenient, easy thing on the surface. Have you ever had, this is what I'm looking for, have you ever had somebody come to you and say, well, you're like this, and you're thinking to yourself, like, I'm not like that at all. You just had, patting him. You're just, like, you get that idea? Like, oh, that's the information I had, it was easy, it was low-hanging fruit, and now I've extrapolated from there, all right? Let's move through these, we're going to run out of time today. Third, desensitization bias. That is what Danny was talking about. The idea of desensitization bias is that my experience colors everything. So if I have four kids, oh, I do have four kids, it would be easy for me if you say, well, I'm having troubles with my two kids, it'd be easy for me to say, you think that's hard? I've got four kids. Or if you have a particular health issue and somebody comes along and says, I have that too, the desensitization bias is that I'm like, oh, well, you have that? I had that, like, you had a cold for 3 days, I had it for five. So whatever you're experiencing must not be that bad. Has anybody had that experience? Somebody do that to you? Has anybody done that to somebody else? where we one-up them in our storytelling so that all of a sudden, this person that we're supposed to be loving, that we're supposed to be seeing, we don't see because we've been desensitized by our own experience. That's what you were saying earlier, right? That what I've experienced allows me not to see you. Yeah. Because of my experience or because of how I think it should be. Yeah, that's good. The fourth one, and there's, by the way, there's lots of these out there. I just thought these four were really important. Attention gap biased. You know what this one is? It's that we have a very limited span of attention. Yeah. It's generation gap. Yeah. Some of it is we only have so much time to care about so many things, and so we can't pay attention to everything all the time. Anybody feel a little overwhelmed some days with, hey, there's this thing, and there's that cause, and there's this thing, and there's that thing, and we want to care about everything, but we just can't focus on that many things, and so we just kind of check out? That's what that bias is about. So the point is, and maybe this isn't interesting to you, is these are ways that we don't see the people around us. There are ways that if we put ourselves in the story, one of the spiritual practices I really love is to think about these stories and put yourself in the story. If I'm Jesus and I'm moving through the crowd and somebody bumps me, and to ask the question of myself, do I see her? If I'm walking through a busy street and the crowds are all around me and there's a guy up in a tree, do I see him? And those things are the things that stop us from actually seeing. Those things and others. But we get stuck in our own ways of thought. What's fascinating about blind spots is they're a myth, at least when it comes to cars. Do you know that? In 1995, Car and Driver magazine published an article by Car Engineers of America, USA, whatever, that basically pointed out that there's no reason that you should have a blind spot in your car. Did you guys know that? I didn't know this till just recently. You know what it requires? It requires you to move your mirrors out. Because when you look in three mirrors, your mirrors are overlapping each other a lot. But we've all learned that when we look in our side view mirrors, you want to see the edge of your car, right? We all set our, most of us, unless you've read Car and Driver in 1995, most of us set our side view mirrors so that we see the edge of our car, which is completely unnecessary. I know what my car looks like. And if we would just take those mirrors and push them out farther so that they don't overlap with what I'm seeing in my center view, your blind spot pretty much goes away. It just requires us to, isn't that mind-blowing? I know! Yes. This led me down a rabbit hole. Like, I was like, no way. And so I had to I have not gotten in my car yet and figured this out because I haven't been with my car all week. But I want to, what?
It's true. My dad taught me that when I was starting.
Of course he did. And so you do that?
Yeah.
So you don't see the edge of your car? How do you know what color your car is? What's that? I can't wait to go home. All right, everybody out of here. Let's go to our cars. I'm going to have kids standing in the driveway behind me today doing mirrors. The point is that all of us, it's so easy for us to move through our lives and just be numb and to not see the hemorrhaging women and the Zacchaeuses. And we have all of those constellation of our own biases and our own reasons that we don't see. But all of that can be unlearned. That we can work through and we can become the kind of people who see the people that need our love. And so I wanted to talk just a minute about what that looks like. So just a couple ideas. First of all, I think we just need to acknowledge that we have blind spots. We do a lot. We're all pretty confident that we know, right? We can all be pretty confident at times. Oh, that what I see, that person is just always like this. I know exactly what's going on with that person. I know what's going on with that situation. I saw them say this thing, so I know it all, right? Anybody been guilty of that? That we've just assumed that we know, and that somewhere along the line, something surprises us? For those of you that aren't married, I'll just tell you, this is what marriage is like. You just assume that you know until you find out you don't know. You don't know, right? Oh, I've been doing this thing for you because I think don't like it. I've hated it for 10 years. Stop it. Oh, yeah. We're like living in a small town. Yeah. And so part of the journey, I think, for some of us, is it's just coming to spaces of saying, I don't know. I don't know what it's like to be that or that situation. I don't know what that person's thinking. I probably don't even have all the details about why that person's doing something that I don't understand. And so part of the journey is just to start by acknowledging what we don't know. Secondly, is rest. This is why I love to tie this back to the first stories we heard of Jesus in this series about Jesus going to the desert to rest, because there's something about resting that just resets us. That sometimes, have you ever been doing this? I'm sure Dave Lynn has had this thing. Like, you're working on a problem and you just get stuck. Some kind of a math thing. And you just get stuck and then you go to sleep, and when you wake up, it's like magic, right? I do this most Sundays. I do the New York Times crossword puzzle. I can't tell you. Like, I'll do the crossword puzzle and then I get stuck and then I go to sleep and then I pick it up and I feel like a total dummy sometimes. Like, how did I not see? That one was so easy. But something about rest and retreating back helps us reset. And this is my case for one of the reasons why we see Jesus retreating in his ministry. The third one, and then I need to move us to communion here quickly, is to start changing routines. To change the way we go about our day and our lives so that we see what we don't often see. If you've ever had a pathway that you drive to work, and then just like simply think of it that way, like, but if I drive this other way, I'm going to see different things. And to think about the routines in our lives and how we might change them. So the thing is, though, is that seeing is just the first step. I think sometimes, especially when we're being overwhelmed by lots of things, is we see, and then what happens? We feel bad. We feel sorry for the person. We may really like feel deep empathy for the person. And then you know, we go to Culver's and we go home, right? And so part of the challenge, I think, in this is to move beyond the theory and say, the first step is Jesus saw Zacchaeus and he saw the woman. And then the second part of it is he did what in both stories? He interacts with the person. He heals the woman. He talks to her. He goes to Zacchaeus' house, invites himself to lunch. In both situations, Jesus engages the person. And so the challenge there is to move from this seeing to a space of action. And specifically, I want to talk about hospitality, because one of the things we're trying to do throughout this Lenten season, if you haven't been here, is to encourage a practice. I love what you said, Kelly. I think that's really like going through it with people. It matters. And so what we're trying to do is each week give you a practice to say, what if we all did this together this week? What if we all tried to practice what it means to see others and to love others? And the specific practice we want to call you to is hospitality. And I love this from Romans. This is from Romans 12. Love from the center of who you are. Don't fake it. Run for dear life from evil. Hold on for dear life to good. Be good friends who love deeply. Practice playing second fiddle. Don't burn out. Keep yourselves fueled in a flame. Be alert servants of the master, cheerfully expectant. Don't quit in hard times. Pray all the harder. Help needy Christians. And I love this last line. Be inventive in your hospitality. Be inventive in your hospitality. So the challenge we want to give to you this week is just that. I could do a whole sermon here, but I have to finish. How might we be inventive in our hospitality this week? Who is it? And so I know what you think. When I say hospitality, what do you first think about? What's the first thing we often think about when I say, if I just got up here and said, all right, everybody, I want everybody to practice hospitality, what do you think about? I'm just curious. Having people over for dinner. Is that a baby step? No, it is not. Having people over for dinner for most of us in the room is stressful and intense. And what happens if they come over and I want them to leave in 10 minutes and they don't leave for 4 hours? Hey, that's real. I've heard you all talk about suppers for six sometimes, right? Oh, come on. That's reality. It's a big ask. It's a hard thing to say, like, I'm just going to invite somebody to my home and I'm going to prepare a 7-course meal for them. Like, no big deal. And so what we want to think about this week is not that. And if that's the way you're wired, if that's who you are, please do that. But I want to lower the bar for the rest of us and ask this week, how might you be inventive in your hospitality? What if we lowered the bar to simply like have a coffee with somebody, meet them for a drink? What if we just went on a walk together? What if we just engage somebody in a conversation just because? I was traveling this week, and you know, it's real easy when I'm traveling, for me at least. As extroverted as I am in so many other places, when I travel, I love to just put on my headphones that say, do not talk to me. And there is something about getting the headphones off and engaging in conversation just out of kindness. I was sitting at O'Hare on Friday, and our flight had been delayed, and I ran into the McCormicks. They're not here today. Oh, yeah, you are. I ran into the McCormicks. We were on the same flight, so we were hanging out at O'Hare, and right before they walked up, this guy across from me had taken a phone call and was clearly, like, distressed in his phone call. And I was trying to read a book, and everything in me wanted to not practice hospitality, right? Like, I don't want to get caught up in this guy's drama, but I could see him, like, after he hung up the phone, he started looking for somebody to talk to. He was just dying to have somebody to talk to. So I was like, if I'm going to preach on this, I should practice it, right? Like, that feels really hypocritical to get up in front of the church on Sunday and tell them to practice hospitality, and I'm doing this, like, trying not to look at the guy so he won't talk to me. So I just looked at him, and he told me he's from, like, just outside of Syracuse, New York, and they're getting hammered with snow. And he was older, and he was away, and his wife had gotten their car stuck in the backyard, and she had already plowed the driveway 3 times with the snow plow. They must live out in the country. They had already plowed the driveway, and every time she plowed it and went back an hour later, there was like 6 more inches of snow, and she was overwhelmed, and I think the keys were in the car running and stuck in the backyard and locked or something. Like, it was just this whole thing, and he's stuck in Chicago, and he's like, I hope I'll be home in a couple hours, and I was like, feeling really bad for the guy because the dude wasn't going to be leaving Chicago. All the flights to the east were being canceled, and it was just bad. But I just took a couple minutes and just talked to the guy. Just inventive hospitality. It doesn't require me to invite him over to my house. If I can do that, that's great. But just to make space for somebody and be kind and listen to his story. And as he was leaving, I just said to him, like, good luck and hope it all works out. And I don't think I'm a saint for doing that. I don't think I get special awards. It's just the really low bar. But it's seeing others and then engaging them in any way that I can. And so specifically this week, what we'd invite you into is to practice inventive hospitality. And I want to push you just a little bit in your practice. And I'm going to be quiet here in just a minute and let you fill out the space on the back of your notes. I want you to think about somebody that's not in your circle. It's easy for me to think about how do I do hospitality with my family or my friends or my neighbors. Maybe not for you. It just depends on who your neighbors are. But I want to ask you to be really specific about how might I see others and then move towards others in love, specifically in terms of hospitality this week. Is there something I know I can do this week to put this into practice? So I'm going to be quiet for about a minute, and I want you, if you just need to have a minute, to sit there with it. And then it's on the back of your notes. I hope you all have notes. On the back of your notes, there's just a line down there where you can write and just be really specific. And I'll just tell you what I said a couple weeks ago about this. The degree to which we can be specific on here, the more likely we are to actually do it. So you might need to say on here, I am going to call so-and-so today to set up coffee for later in the week. That's nice and specific, all right? Before I go to sleep tonight, I'm going to reach out to this person. Or when I go to work on Monday, I'm going to ask this person to join me for lunch. Whatever the thing is, the more specific you can be about it, the more likely we will be to actually do the things. And so I'm just going to be quiet now and give you space to process that, and then I'll pray to finish out the service. God, I think this room is full of really good people, and we don't always mean to not see. We just kind of get busy and we get caught up in our own stuff, and there's just crowds around all the time, and so we just miss opportunities to love. And we ask that you help us to see, help us to move past our blind spots, help us to maybe change up our routines or see things in a way that's different than we've seen before. And when we see, then give us the courage to act in love. And help us to know the right things to do in those moments. And it could be as simple as a conversation, or as complicated as we want it to be, or as involved as we want it to be. And so just help us to know that in that space. Thank you for this Lenten season and what Kelly said. Thank you for the community of saints that we walk through it together with, and we practice this together and can share our successes and share our failures and know that we're not in this alone. In your name I pray. Amen.